Well, I guess I was about 12, 13, maybe 14. I was living in Ohio, and I bought a copy, a paperback, of course, of The Illustrated Man. It just came out. So this was in the early 50s. And I loved it because I've been reading science fiction, and I just loved it. I just loved the book, and it was poetic. And so the kid who lived up the block also read science fiction. So after I read The Illustrated Man, I ran up the block, and I said, Charlie, you've got to read. This is the greatest book I've ever read. It's a masterpiece. It's wonderful. So he borrowed it, and he read it, and he came back the next day, and he said, I didn't think it was so hot.
Well, that happens. Yeah. All kinds of adventures in my life. I was in an airport going to Europe 2 years ago, and a woman came up to me and said, are you some sort of writer? I said, yes. She said, what's your name? I said, Ray Bradbury. She said, be still, my beating heart. But then, immediately after that, in London, at Brown's Hotel, a bellboy, 17 years old, took my luggage up to my room, and we got in, he put the luggage down. He looked at me, he says, Mr. Bradbury, are you a fairly well-known author? I said, well, sort of. He said, well, you know, I've been asking around the hotel all day today, in the kitchen and the front and out and back, and nobody seems to know who you are. And he turned, went to the door, he said, but don't worry, your secret's safe with me. So you get these two angles all the time.
Well, one of our desk assistants picked up the phone as you were coming into the building, and she said, someone downstairs is calling for Mr. Bradbury. He doesn't work here, does he? I said, no, I'm expecting Ray Bradbury to visit. She said, well, who's Ray Bradbury?
There you go.
And I said, well, he's a writer. And all of a sudden, her eyes lit up.
Yeah.
And she said, Fahrenheit 451.
There you go.
How long is he going to be here? Maybe I have time to run home and get my copy of the book and have him sign it for me.
And friend Orson Welles. I did a one-hour radio show on CBS New Year's Eve, 1984. He read from Orwell, and I tried to interpret. And we had a wonderful, wonderful evening together.
Yeah, you really had a great past, and of course your new book deals with John Huston. It's a wonderful tale. Well, let's work up to that, because
okay.
I'd like to go back, since we've never chatted, and ask you about some of your formative years. You were born in Waukegan, right? Waukegan,
that's
Illinois?
Right. My mother went to school with Jack Benny 95 years ago, and they were in grade school together. So I grew up knowing Jack Benny and people like that. But there weren't many famous people in our town. And Jack and myself were just about it, huh? But it was a great way to start. I lived there till I was 13. And then when puberty came into sight, it was a good time to leave. And my dad was looking for work in the Great Depression. He was out of work for years. And we went to Hollywood. We went to L.A., and which is the greatest thing ever happened to me, because I was a couple of blocks away from a MGM flagship theater. And once a week, they'd have a preview there, and I'd see the light flashing on top of the theater, run over, and Norma Shearer would drive up with Irving Thalberg in a big limousine. She'd get out in a silver lamé dress. They were on their way to the Coconut Grove after the preview. And so my life was full up with famous people at least once a week.
Mm. Back in Waukegan, do you ever get back there at all? Do they ever have a Ray Bradbury week or something?
Well, a fabulous thing happened a year ago. Back in 1926, my brother and I would go to the movies, especially the Lon Chaney films, Hunchback of Notre Dame and what have you. And The Phantom of the Opera appeared in Waukegan in 1925. And we came home late at night through the ravine, a very dark ravine. And I was 6 years old, my brother was 10. And he ran ahead on this bridge and hid under it so that when I crossed, he jumped out at me. Well, I screamed all the way home. My father beat the hell out of my brother. But last year, you know, 67 years later, Waukegan invited me back, and they renamed that bridge the Ray Bradbury Park. And the six-year-old in me jumped up and down with delight. What a wonderful thing to have happen.
So it's an actual park name for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the ravine is still the same. It's still very dark and mysterious, and I wouldn't dream of going down there at night, even this late in time. But now it belongs to me, and they've got a trail going down called the Dandelion Trail, named after my novel, The Dandelion Wine. So, and I invited my aunt to come with me. She's like an older sister. She's 82. And she was the biggest influence in my life with art and theater. And she designed dresses for the Chicago Opera and that sort of thing. And then I invited my girlfriend from the first grade, because I walked to school with her every day for 8 or 9 years. And I hadn't seen her in about 40 years. So she came with her daughter, and we cried 3 days in a row.
You evoke so well small-town America in your work. I assume that you were able to draw on Waukegan for some of the
stories. Yeah, and you do this, you don't even know what you're doing. The best way to write is just to write. And these things pour out, and the more you unplug the metaphors, the faster they come. And you put them down, and you're not quite certain whether some of these things happened or not. And I went back to Waukegan about 8 years ago and walked down the main street where I hadn't been in many years. And I came to the town barbershop. It still had the name of the man who was my grandmother's boarder, Lee Wineski, up in front. And I knew that he died about 2 years before. And I stepped into the shop, and here's this elderly barber there, and about 75 or so. And when he took one look at me, he threw his scissors on the floor. He says, "By God, I've been waiting 40 years for you to come through that door." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I was your grandma's boarder when you were 3 years old." I said, "My God." He says, "Sit in the chair. Let's talk." So I got in the chair, and he then went back in time. He says, "You know, the one thing I remember about you and your brother is your granddad giving you both gunny sacks and pointing over across the street and say, 'Go pick these full of dandelions. I'll give you a nickel a sack.' And you and your brother went over and brought these sacks of dandelions back, put down the basement, put them in a wine press, crushed them down, and made wine, and put them in ketchup bottles lined up on the sill facing the sunlight late in the day, and with a sign on each one, 'Summer 1921, Summer 1922, Summer 1923. And I sat in the chair and I wept. I said, "My God, it's true." I wasn't sure when I wrote the book whether I was remembering something or making something up. And here's the town barber telling me that I was writing the truth. Wonderful thing.
How did it happen that you began to write? Because your first work, you were very young when that happened.
Yeah, I fell in love with all kinds of arts starting when I was 3 and saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Lon Chaney became the center of my life. I saw his films as often as I could. In those days, it was almost impossible. Occasionally they'd bring back a film, maybe 5 years later. But I fell in love with the science fiction magazines, the covers of the magazines, the architectures of the future, Science and Invention magazine, Popular Mechanics, all the things that I suppose a lot of boys are in love with. But I was fanatic, and I couldn't afford to buy the magazines, so I had to borrow them from people, or my grandma's boarders would bring them in. And Buck Rogers came into my life when I was 9, and a single panel in the October newspaper, 1929, sent me raving into the future. I started collecting Buck Rogers, and then all the Tarzan Sunday strips by Harold Foster, and then later Prince Valiant for 30 years, and Flash Gordon. And I fell in love then with Tarzan, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and Jules Verne, H.G. Wells. And I was maddened. And by the time I was 12, it all exploded, and I began to write. And I haven't stopped writing for one day in the last 60 years.
When did you publish your first story?
When I was 20. There was a magazine in Beverly Hills called Script, which was a pale imitation of The New Yorker. But it did publish people like Saroyan and a few people like that. And I sold them 4 things in 1 year, and there was no money. I just get a free subscription to the magazine. But seeing your name in print, and having a letter arrive in the mail saying, "I like your story, it's not the heat, it's the hue." When I opened the envelope in front of our house in L.A., I yelled at my mother, and she came down and read it, and we danced around the lawn together. So that's how important writing has always been to me.
Were these science fiction stories?
No, they were humor. I liked to do that sort of thing in high school. I worked for the blue and white newspaper. I wrote the student talent show the last year in high school. And then I joined Lorraine Day's little theater group, which was only a few blocks from my house, and she was a big movie star at the time at MGM, making films like Foreign Correspondent for Hitchcock. And so the theater was in my blood, writing humor was in my blood, and science fiction and weird tales were in my blood. And my first big successes were in Weird Tales, where I began to write every issue for 3 or 4 years. I got the magnificent sum of 1 cent a word. So most of my stories, which are very well known today, sold for $15 or $20. That means the Martian Chronicles, too. Most of those stories were in science fiction magazines in the early 40s and the late 50s. And I sold them for about $40 apiece.
Hard to make a living as a science fiction writer, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I lived at home till I was 27. I couldn't afford to leave, and it's a good thing I didn't. You know, a lot of people feel they've got to get out in that big world, which is going to eat them up if they're not careful, and you won't have time to write. So I got a job selling newspapers on a street corner for 3 or 4 years. I made $10 a week, which in 1939 bought you all your clothes. You get a good sport coat for $12. Pair of pants for $5, pair of shoes for $4, socks for 50 cents, a decent shirt for $2, and a tie for $1. And there you got your whole outfit. So I didn't live high on the hog, but I'd take girls to movies on occasion, which cost me $1 for 2 people, and 2 malted milks after, that's 20 more cents. So it was a cheap evening, but a fun evening.
Well, you've had a tremendous career, some I believe. 28 books, something like that?
Something like that, yes.
And your first novel was Dark Carnival.
It was a book of short stories, yeah.
Oh, it was a book of short stories?
Yeah.
That came out about, what, 46?
47, yeah.
47?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was followed by The Illustrated Man?
Martian Chronicles, and then The Illustrated Man.
But all of these essentially were short stories. But
that's right.
But although... The Martian Chronicles and The Illustrated Man seemed like a novel.
Well, what happened is when my first book came out, Dark Carnival, I so much admired Norman Corwin, who was the greatest radio writer, producer, and director in history, and still is. I sent him a copy of the book, and I got his phone number and address from the secretary at CBS, and I put a note in with it saying, if you like my stories as much as I love you and your stories, I want to buy you a drink some afternoon. A week later, I got a phone call from Norman Corwin. He says, you're not buying me drinks, I'm buying you dinner. And we became close, fast friends forever. And over the years, he kept nagging me. He says, you got to go to New York. You got to meet people. People don't know you exist. Now, Katie and I are going to New York in spring. This is 1949. And you've got to come, and we'll take you around New York, and we'll protect you. So I came here on the Greyhound bus in the spring of 49. My wife was pregnant. We had $40 in the bank, nothing else. And Norman took me around, and he and his wife and gave me a wonderful time. And I sat in on watching him do a broadcast at CBS for one of his great United Nations shows. And along the way, I met an editor at Doubleday. And he says, don't you have a novel? I said, I'm not a novelist. I'm a short story writer. He says, well, what about all those Martian short stories that you've been writing the last 5 years? Wouldn't they hang together somehow if you sewed them into a tapestry? I said, my God, you know, at one time years ago I thought about that, but forgot it in the meantime. He said, I tell you what, go back to the YMCA tonight, type me out an outline, and if I like it, I'll give you an advance tomorrow. So I stayed up all night, did the outline of the Martian Chronicles, took it back, and he said, that's it, here's $700, which was a lot of money in 1949. It paid our rent for 2 years, huh? And then he says, what else have you got? I said, I got all these other short stories. He says, can you figure out a way to make them look like a novel? Martian Chronicles is very close to a novel. I said, well, I've got The Illustrated Man. He's a metaphor. Maybe I'll write a preface in which he then leads you into all these stories, all these illustrations. And Mr. Walter Bradbury was his name, no relation, said, that's it. Now I'll give you another $700. So I went home rich, and our baby was born, and the next year the Martian Chronicles came out, and my whole life turned around.
The rest is history, I guess.
It sure is. Well, it's all over the world. It's just, I had a wonderful thing happen in a train station in Paris 12 years ago. I was coming up from Italy, and my wife and I got off in this big station there. And there were 1,000 people waiting for cabs. No way to get one. So I turned to my wife. I said, let's walk up in the station, sit down somewhere, and eventually the crowd will be gone. We started walking up into the station, and the baggage handler came around the corner, a man in his 40s. He took one look at me. He says, oh, Ray Bradbury, Martian Chronicles. I said, yes. He says, you need a cab. I said, yes, we do. So he took us to a private telephone, and we got a cab, and when I got home, I sent him the Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, and that book is still being read, and and in fact, it was filmed just a couple of years ago. I saw it on television.
Yeah, it was on the other network, as we say, and they didn't do a good job. It was mainly boring. It wasn't bad. It was just boring. So I've been doing it over on my own television show during the last year, the Ray Bradbury Theater, and I've done at least 8 of the episodes over, and done them right this time, and they're very good. I'm very, very proud of them.
Tell me about the Ray Bradbury Theater.
Well, it started about, the whole thing started about 10 years ago, and it took 2 years for my producers to talk me into doing it because I was afraid. I'd had a lot of bad experiences with various network shows and with feature films, and I said, I want guarantees. You know, I don't want to get hurt anymore. I can't take it. And I said, I want to write all the scripts. That way, if anything goes wrong, you can blame me. And then I want to help edit. I want to help cast. And if anything goes wrong, I want the right to criticize. And I won't throw my weight around, but I do want to be able to help. And once I got that guarantee, we did the show, and we've done 65 of them now. Just finished 25 new ones in New Zealand and Canada. And they're wonderful. The quality is fantastic. And some of the performances are heartbreakingly good. And we've won a lot of awards. We've got 30 cable network nominations and about 17 awards altogether. And worked with people like Peter O'Toole and Hal Linden and Tyne Daly during the last month and film over there. So you're looking at a happy author. There are not many of them around, huh?
Another major book of yours, Fahrenheit 451, and there were a lot of comparisons to Orwell with that book. How did that one come about?
Well, it came about because I grew up in a small town with a fire department. And my father and I, when we'd walk down to the beach on a summer afternoon, we'd stop in at the fire department and pet the Dalmatian, and talk to the fire chief. So I began to write about fire departments when I was very young, and the stuff accumulated. And finally, during the... And, of course, Hitler, when he came along, was burning books like crazy. And Russia was doing it, and China was doing it. And it reached a certain point during the McCarthy period, and just prior to that, when Parnell Thomas was the head of the Un-American Activities Committee. They didn't burn books, but they threatened a lot of people. And it made me very angry. And so just natural that eventually all this fire department material accumulated, and I wrote a short story in early 1950 about that something that happened to me. I went for a walk with a friend of mine. We were talking books, and this is down in the center of L.A. somewhere. And a police car pulled up, and a policeman got out and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Putting one foot in front of the other," which was the wrong answer, you know, smart ass. And he questioned us, and I said, "You don't understand. A criminal wouldn't be seen walking anywhere. And this is a car society, so why should we call attention to ourselves by walking, huh?" And he thought about it, and it sank in after a while. And he reprimanded us, and I said, "Yes, sir, I'm going home, and I'll never walk again." Again, being very smart. And I went home. I was so angry at the encounter because, you know, obviously we were innocent. No one would walk anywhere. And I wrote the short story called The Pedestrian, about a city in the future where no one walks and there are robot police cars, and this one guy gets arrested for being a pedestrian, and they carry him off for psychiatric reorganization. And out of that short story, a week or two later, I took my pedestrian out for a walk again, and he turned a corner, and there's a young girl standing there, and she She sniffs him, and she says, "Kerosene, you must be the fireman, the man who starts fires rather than puts them out and burns books." And 9 days later, the novel was finished. So these things are always surprises with me. And I wrote the novel in the basement of the UCLA library, in a typing room filled with students, 12 or 14 other students. You'd go into this room and put a dime in the slot under a typewriter and shove it in, and you type like crazy for half an hour, mm-hmm. and then run upstairs and get more dimes. So in a period of 8 or 9 days, I spent $9.80 in dimes and wrote Fahrenheit 451. So that's how it all happened.
Why didn't you have your own typewriter?
I was poor. I couldn't afford one. And the one that I did have was at home, and my home was filling with children, and I couldn't hear myself think. And I worked in the garage because we had no car, but my two daughters would run around back and tap on the window and say, "Daddy, come out and play." Well, I went out and played, of course, and our income went down. So I realized I had to have a place where the children couldn't tempt me. And so a couple hours a day, I'd go up to UCLA and use the typing room. And I did that for about 2 years. And then other friends of mine gave me the loan of an office.
Do you still have that office?
No, the friends moved out of that particular building. And later on, my agents, my Hollywood agents, had an extra room. I went over and typed there. And I finally, when they moved out, I took over their office, and I had a free lease there for a year. And now I have my office in the basement of my home, which is crammed with all my junk. If you've ever seen the opening to the Ray Bradbury Theater, that's my real office with Bullwinkle in the background. He's about 9 foot tall, and toys and posters and magic sets and all the things to me that are the most important things in life.
But you're not, obviously not just a science fiction writer. You write just about anything in your new book, Green Shadows, White Whale, centers around the writing of the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston.
Yeah.
And that was quite, as I was reading Green Shadows, White Whale, I was trying to figure out what was real and what was fantasy. I wasn't sure exactly. But at any rate, Huston must have been a really colorful guy to work with.
Very colorful and very strange and very self-destructive. Yeah, I don't think he ever accepted himself. I don't know what. I think he wanted to be a writer all of his life, and he never was. He got credit on a lot of screenplays that he didn't write. And he had collaborations with authors, but 80% of the work was done by the other author. During the writing of the screenplay of Moby Dick, which took me 7 months to do, John was not satisfied one day with a scene that I'd done, and he says, "Let me show you how to do it." So I went away for an hour, and he typed out a scene, and when I came back, he handed it to me. And I went into shock. It was so bad. But I couldn't say anything. Here's my hero. And here's my employer. Here's one of the great directors in the world. But just because you're a great director doesn't mean you're a great writer. There are very few of those. Billy Wilder is the exception. He has a long career that goes way back to Ninotchka, and before that he collaborated on Ninotchka with, I think, Mr. Brackett, his partner. And then he did a lot of screenplays before he ever directed. And then all of his screenplays for the last 30 or 40 years have been collaborations with I.E.L. Diamond or Mr. Brackett. But Wilder was the spark in the engine, the creative spark. But Huston never learned to write, and I think that made him terribly unhappy.
How did it happen that Huston summoned you to Ireland to do the screenplay?
Well, again, we go back to childhood root systems. I try to teach writers or artists or anyone interested in doing something creative to hold on to their total life, everything from the year one on up. The things that seem silly and unimportant. I fell in love with dinosaurs when I was six, The Lost World, the MGM film. Saw King Kong when I was 13, fell madly in love with King Kong.
You wrote a book about dinosaurs.
That's right, yeah, one of my most recent books. And I met a young man when I was 18 who built dinosaurs in his garage and animated them on film, and he became my closest friend. And we promised ourselves a life full of dinosaurs. I was going to write screenplays for him, and he was going to animate them. And we had this loving dream, which we shared. And he was best man at my wedding 44 years ago. And I wrote a whole bunch of dinosaur short stories. And one of them appeared in The Golden Apples of the Sun, the story of the dinosaur who falls in love with a lighthouse and thinks it's another dinosaur and discovers it isn't. It's a foghorn and a lighthouse, tears the whole thing down, and dies of a broken heart on the beach. Huh? I gave all my material to John Huston on St. Valentine's night in 1951. I had dinner with him, my only contact with him. And he wrote me from Africa a month later. He was doing the African Queen. And he said, "You're right. Someday we'll work together. Don't know on what. Don't know on what." And so we wrote back and forth twice in 2 years. And he read that dinosaur story, The Foghorn. And he called me to his hotel in August 1953, put a drink in my hand, and said, "What are you doing during the next year, Ray?" And I said, "Not much, not much." He says, "Well, how'd you like to come? I live in Ireland and write the screenplay of Moby Dick." And I said, "Gee, Mr. Huston, I've never been able to read the damn thing, huh?" So he said, "Well, tell you what, Ray, go home tonight, read as much as you can, and come back tomorrow and tell me if you'll help me kill the white whale." Well, I went home and I took the job. I read as much as I could. And we met Huston in Paris. We went to London, then we went to Ireland, and I lived there for 7 months. And during that time of walking in the rain every night and knowing all the beggars and the people playing harps and violins and banjos and pianolas, and going in the pubs and meeting the people there, and seeing Sean O'Casey right there in front of you, I soaked in all of Ireland and didn't know it, because friends wrote to me and said, "Are you going to write about Ireland someday?" I said, "No, no way. I haven't had time to see, to know. I'm too busy with the white whale." And I was home about 8 months in America when this voice spoke in my head and said, "Ray, darling." I said, "Who's that?" He said, "Ah, God, you know, it's Nick, your cab driver. You remember all those rides back and forth from Dublin to Gilcocca, those nights of mist and rain and fog, and I'm pointing out to you where the nuns live over here and the priests are over there at Maynooth, and about the witch here in this village, etc." I said, "Yes." He said, "Ray, would you mind putting it down?" And I wrote the first short story, then I wrote 3 one-act plays about Ireland, and then I wrote a long play about Ireland. And the stories came out one after another based on things I saw in the newspaper, that bicyclists in Ireland collide with each other and kill each other. That doesn't happen in America. I had never heard of it before. But about 400 bicyclists a year are killed in and around Dublin because the bicyclists are going too fast and they hit each other. And if you hit your head against someone else's head at 60 miles an hour, because this one's going 30 miles an hour this way and the other one's going 30 the other way, at 60 miles an hour when they hit, so you get killed. So I immediately wrote a short story about that, and then my wife and I went to the movies every night, and there wasn't much to do in Dublin. I did my writing during the day, had my meetings with Huston 3 or 4 nights a week. And we went to the movies, a lot of revivals, Deanna Durbin, great stuff, huh? And old Burt Lancaster films. And we discovered that every night when the movie was over, we got the hell out ahead of the national anthem, because they played it every night, every night, and every night. And so I said, "I'm going to form a team of anthem sprinters and have various, there would be the Galway Lightfoots, et cetera, et cetera. And these teams compete with each other to see who gets out of the theater fastest." So that's where that story came from. And then the first Night of Lent story is an actual, complete, honest story. I discovered that Nick, I'd been driving with him for 120 nights, and I asked him what he was going to give up for Lent, and he says, "Yeah, these things hanging from my lips, you know, dire congestions of the lung, and dear as gold fillings, I'm giving them up for Lent and long after." And so the next night, the first night of Lent, he showed up, and we'd been driving nice and slow and easy the rest of the time. All of a sudden, first night of Lent, we're off at 90 miles an hour, knocking cows sidewise and scaring priests off the road. And I look it over to him, and his face is blazing with smoke and fire. He's smoking like crazy. And I said, Nick, it's lit. And he said, I give up the ether. I said, give up the ether? What do you mean? And he says, and I realized that suddenly he'd given up drinking, and for the first night in 120 nights, he was sober. Huh? It scared the hell out of me. And the next night, I made him drink something so that we'd drive nice and slow and careful back to Dublin. So that whole story is real. And there's a story in here about two of the beggars in Dublin, one who was blind with an accordion on O'Connell Bridge. And Houston and I noticed him on many occasions. He didn't wear a cap, and he let the rain beat on his head, which drove me crazy, huh? And I bought a cap to give to him because it drove me wild to see him so wet. And he didn't use the cap. And that made me even angrier. I thought he was trying to get us to sympathize with his state, huh? And I hated myself later for my attitude because when I was working with Houston one night in my apartment in the hotel, we opened the newspaper and there was a little item at the bottom. Beggar on O'Connell Bridge throws his accordion into the river and jumps after it. And he was never found. And it hurt so terribly that I had to write the story. So that portion of the novel, again, is absolute fact. And all the material on Houston is something that actually happened with him. He used to try to scare me about sounds outside the house late at night. We'd be drinking by the fireplace. And and I'm drinking whiskey, which I hated, but I drank it because John drank it. And every other night or so, he'd say, Ray, you hear that sound out there, Ray, in the night there? That weird, mournful sound. You know what that is, Ray? No, what is it, John? That is a banshee. A banshee, Ray. Now, I tell you what. Get my coat, and you go out and bring the banshee in. No, John, I don't want to do that. No, don't be yellow, Ray. Don't be yellow. Go on out and bring the banshee in. And, of course, I never did. But later, I wrote this short story, two-thirds of which is factual reportage of John trying to get me to do this, huh? And the ending, of course, didn't happen, and I put a different ending on it.
Now, Ray, the death of the squire who was bound to take with him all of that valuable wine, now that could not have possibly happened.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It didn't happen in Ireland. It happened over in London. My wife and I were driving around out to various universities in Blenheim, where Churchill was born. And we had a wonderful limousine driver who told us stories along the way. And he told us this story of a lord who was buried with his wine, huh? And which is a terrible thing to do. We have all this lovely stuff. He took it with him. You know the old saying, you can't take it with you? Well, he was buried with his wine, and then someone came up with the idea of getting around the codicil in the will of, does it matter how the wine gets in the grave? And so all these men stand around the grave and drink the wine first, and eventually it gets into the grave. Well, I wrote the story immediately, and then there's another section of the novel about the burning of a house, Grinwood, and Nora is the woman's name, and it's called The Haunting of the New. And it, as based on an actual event, I got a letter through the mail from my friend Lord Kilbracken, a wonderful man that we met and visited outside of Dublin. And he went to India a few years ago. He was gone for 2 years. When he came home, he went out to visit Una Oren Moran Brown, is the name of the actual lady, one of the Guinness girls, huh? And he went out to her house, and he walked through, and he looked at her, and he says, gee, this house feels funny. There's something's wrong. What can it be? She said, this is not the house. And he said, what? She said, the house burned down 2 years ago when you were gone. And I had it rebuilt brick by brick. Every pane, every book on the shelves, every painting was replaced exactly the way it was when it burned down. I reproduced everything. It took 2 full years of work. And this is not the house. This is a new house, totally. But when I read this in the letter, bang, I was off to the typewriter. And 3 hours later, I had the short story. So it's combinations of truths.
Now, you write about a dispute with John Huston, who wanted you to fly to London to finish the screenplay, but of course you were afraid to fly, and you were insisting that you were going to take the ferry.
That's right.
And that prompted a manic episode of writing in which you almost became Herman Melville.
I did. I really did. And it's a good lesson. I want to teach it to people. That if you adapt other people's work, it's awfully hard to do. Because you are not them, huh? I am me, and the reason I write as well as I do is I've lived with me all these years, and all these metaphors come out of my own subconscious. They're not borrowed, huh? But when you're working on Herman Melville, he's outside you, and the book is outside you. So it took me 7 months of rereading some sections 100 times, some sections 50 times. Until I found all the metaphors that I needed, and they were in my bloodstream, in my nervous system, and I didn't have to think about them anymore. If you try to think a thing into existence, you're going to do it wrong. Huh? People use their intellects in the wrong way. The intellect is there to correct an act after it's finished, not before, because you never know what you're going to do when you're painting, when you're acting, when you're writing. You have to let yourself go. Dare to be emotional, that's okay. That doesn't mean you're not going to use your intellect eventually. You just delay it for 5 minutes or 6 months. So on a certain day in London, I got out of bed, looked in the mirror, and said, I am Herman Melville. And I sat down at the typewriter. I didn't eat. I barely moved for the next 8 hours. And it all poured out. It all came right. All the metaphors fused. The big ones with the next large size and the smaller ones and the teeny ones. And they had a skin around them. And 8 hours later, late in the afternoon, I got a sandwich and called Houston on the phone, ran over to his hotel and threw the script in his lap. I said, there, I think it's all done. And he read and he says, by God, it is. And it was, so next time you see the film, the last half hour to 45 minutes happened in one day, and all the metaphors were perfect finally, and they fit in place.
It's a terrific film too. You know, they run it, I used to vacation a lot on Nantucket. They run it every night on Nantucket.
Oh, that's great.
In a garage theater. That's where I first saw Moby Dick. And
I'm very proud. I saw Greg Peck in Washington a year ago. We were both there to have lunch with Gorbachev and Galbraith and Eugene McCarthy, Ted Turner, and Jane Fonda. It was a wonderful day, but on the way back from the hotel, Greg Peck picked me up and drove me to the hotel. And on the way, I said, Greg, how do you feel about Ahab, 36 years later? He said, well, I was awfully young, and I didn't have much malice. But I'm older now, and I have malice.
That's why you could play Ambrose Bierce as well as he did in The Old Gringo. Did you see that film?
No, I didn't. Yeah.
The movie wasn't very good, but Peck was terrific.
Oh, he's a fine actor, and he's a fine gentleman too. He's a real sweetie pie.
Are you still afraid to fly?
No, I got over that 9 years ago. I was down in for the opening of Epcot. I worked on the main building there, the spaceship Earth. I created the interior, the dialogue, and what have you. And on the way, I lectured in New Orleans. I got there by train, and then I discovered the train had been canceled permanently down to Orlando. So I hired a limousine with an old colored retainer. An old colored retainer. He was not black. He was an old colored, old-fashioned colored man. And he was about, I was 62 at the time, and he was 75 at least. And he shouldn't have been driving, but we got out on the highway, and that first thing that happened in the middle of the freeway, we blow a tire. So I'm out there with this old colored retainer changing the tire, which is no fun. And it took another hour after that to get a really good spare tire, because the spare was no good. And then late in the afternoon, the car broke down completely. The engine fell out, and that was the end of the car. They shot it behind the crankcase, and that was the end. And we drifted into a Holiday Inn, and I stayed the night and got 2 six-packs of beer and watched the World Series. And the next day, called a cab from somewhere. I can't remember what the town was. And the cab driver turned up. He was the town sheriff. He was right out of Smokey and the Bandit, huh? So the town sheriff drove me to Orlando and gave me a wonderful lecture about everything on the way. And when I got down to the opening of Epcot, I said to the Disney people, God has given me a message today. They said, what is it? And the message was, fly, dummy. So I said, give me a ticket, get me drunk, and send me home when the celebration is over. So 3 days later, They took me to the airport. The president of Delta was there to welcome me because it was a big day. Bradbury's finally coming out of the womb, huh? And they put three double martinis in me, floated me to my seat, belted me in, and I took my first flight. And I was surrounded by Disney people going home, which made it very easy. But then as time passed and I flew more, I discovered that I wasn't afraid of flying. I was afraid of me, and that was the great secret. I was afraid I'd run up and down the aisles and scream and embarrass everyone, and I want to get off. And when that didn't happen, the fear went away completely. And now it's gone forever. I don't have to drink anymore, and I fly around the world, and never one ounce of fear. So if a lot of people who think they're afraid of flying are listening to me, they should stop and think maybe they're afraid of themselves.
Wonderful stories. I guess you're a born storyteller. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, I grew up on fairy tales and comic strips, and my aunt was a huge influence with Grimm's fairy tales and the Oz books, and I read books that were storytelling, huh? And, well, inventions are themselves metaphors, and I read up on all the poetry of the world, which means I'm crammed full of those metaphors, on art history, so that I have on file in my head from natural loving all these metaphors. If more people would cram themselves with haiku, for instance, and poetry, they'd better make better filmmakers.
Yes, and in fact, you are a poet, even though you have written a number of books of poetry.
Yeah, 12 of them. Yeah.
Yeah. But your prose is poetic,
yeah.
And that's a big difference from many, many writers who just write basic stuff.
But I didn't know I was doing it. See, that's the great thing about writing. You should never know what you're doing. Just do it. And, well, I was... this book, Green Shadows, White Whale, took 37 years to write off and on, with a lot of other books in between. I was going to Europe a couple of years ago, and the novel just before this, Graveyard for Lunatics, came to me because I saw a man with a destroyed face on board ship with me. And his face was so terribly disfigured that I wept 5 seconds after he passed me on the top deck. And his face haunted me, and when I got to Paris, I'd seen him with his wife and daughter at dinner every night for 5 nights, and they were laughing and drinking champagne, and they'd forgotten his face. Huh? So there's a message of love there, and it's right out of a Lon Chaney film, isn't it? That's what most of his films were about, Quasimodo and the Phantom. And so every night for 10 nights, I sat in the dark with a silent typewriter, and my wife was asleep 10 feet away. And I typed in the dark without seeing what I wrote, and I did 150 pages of A Graveyard for Lunatics. And when I got home, I finished it. I never read it during the whole time I wrote it, because I don't believe in knowing what you're doing. You let your intuition know, and you have to know with the cognizant mind. And when I was down in Italy, I got to know Fellini years ago, Federico Fellini, and discovered he worked the same way. I've had many, many days with him. We have a wonderful friendship. And I said to him one evening, I hear, Federico, when you make a film, you never look at the rushes. He said, that's right. I said, why do you do that? He says, I don't want to know what I'm doing. It's exactly what I've been saying for years. Do the thing, huh? Create the thing. And when it's all over, 60 days later, you run the rushes. And if you need to do some work on swell, then your intellect tells you what to do. But your intuition, your ganglion, should be working for you all the time. That's why so much fiction is so bad, because it's self-conscious. And or why many screenplays are bad. People take jobs they shouldn't be taking. They will take money for anything. And I've turned down 40 films in the last 30 years because I knew they weren't right for me. And anyway, I wanted to finish another book. I turned down Man with a Golden Arm, Good Morning, Miss Dove, Diabolique. That's a great film. I wonder what it would have been like if I'd written it. It's a brilliant film. I'm glad I didn't take the screenplay. But I decided I'd want to write more books and write them without knowing what I was doing, like the Martian Chronicles.
Somebody asked a famous author once, how long does it take you to write a novel? And the author replied, a lifetime.
That's right. It's all in there, and you're regurgitating things. See, I remember being born, and it's a valuable memory to have. And I had nightmares in the crib during the week after of being born again and again and again. And I remembered this when I saw my own daughter in her crib 42 years ago, and she was having nightmares. And my wife said, "What can she have nightmares about?" I said, "Only one thing, being born 5 days ago." And I remember being ejected, coming out into the light, and crying. And I remember the camera angle in my crib, and I called my mother. This is the second week after our first daughter was born. And I said to my mother, "How long did you suckle me?" She said, 2 days. I said, "I remember the flavor." And she said, I said, "How soon after I was born was I circumcised?" She said, "On the fifth or sixth day." I said, "It wasn't at the hospital, was it?" She said, "No." And I said, "It wasn't at home, no. Did my father take me somewhere?" I remember being carried, and I was just a week old. And she said, "Yes." I said, "Did he take me downtown and go upstairs to a doctor's office?" She said, "Yes." I said, "I remember being laid out on the table. I remember the doctor leaning over me with a scalpel, and I remember the pain." Now, there's no way for all those memories to get in there, you see, because those things were never discussed. It was a Victorian time. I never heard my mother or father swear ever in their life or discuss anything sexual or personal. So these memories have to be authentic. And then I said to her, "Was my crib facing the north in your bedroom?" So I looked across your bed at a window, and she said, "Yes." And I said, "Was my head to the west and my feet to the east?" She said, "Yes, they were." Of course, when you experience those things, you don't know the directions, but you remember the camera angle, and you can ask about the directions later on. So I'm lucky as a writer. I remember all the movies starting when I was two. I saw a number of films that year. And then from three on, everything. I saw all the silent films. My mother was a maniac for films, so I saw three or four films a week because my mother would take me before I went to school. And then when I was in the first grade, she'd get me after school and take me to the movies. So I grew up completely submerged in movies.
Well, it's extraordinary that you have that that memory, and that must be ammunition that you can draw on.
It is. I wrote a short story called The Small Assassin, about a baby that kills its parents because it didn't want to be born. It liked it in there where it was nice and warm and comfortable.
Well, Ray Bradbury, it was great having the chance to talk to you and finding out about you, and wonderful and hilarious stories. One of the stories I really loved was about the beggar woman's baby who looked at you straight in the eye. And, "That can't be true. I saw that baby 30 years ago." Wonderful.
That's partially true. And McGillahey's breath. Yeah. And anyway, I had a ball doing the novel, and I hope people will